Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Gandhi as a philosopher.
I have never made a statement that the masses of India, if it became necessary, would resort to violence.
Gandhi articulated nonviolence as a philosophy. He practiced nonviolence as a leader.
He changed history through civil disobedience.
I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace. I know the value of discipline and truth.
Gandhi's philosophy of brahmacharya meant control of the senses in thought, word, and deed.
The safest course is to believe in the moral government of the world, and therefore in the supremacy of the moral law, the law of truth and love.
Our guest is Akhil Bilgrami from Columbia University.
Gandhi, the philosopher, coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, Gandhi as philosopher.
Mahatma Gandhi was a great spiritual and political leader. He was father of the Indian independence movement. He was the man who preached and practiced nonviolence, and he inspired millions around the world, including America's own apostle of nonviolence, Martin Luther King. But you don't usually think of Gandhi as a philosopher.
But he was, John. He was certainly all the things you just mentioned, and he was also a profound philosophical thinker. Now, he wasn't an academic philosopher like you and me, but he certainly wrote a lot that could be called philosophy.
Academic philosophers like us will find his philosophical writings frustrating, at least at times. But when you realize that Gandhi's spirituality, his approach to politics, and his philosophical outlook are all interconnected, then you realize that if you want to understand this phenomenon, the phenomenon of Gandhi, you also have to understand his philosophical outlook.
So let's have a taste of Gandhi as philosopher and how that might help us better understand Gandhi, the spiritual and political phenomenon.
Well, take Gandhi's views about morality. You might think that the leader of nonviolent non-cooperation, as he liked to call it, would be big on morally condemning his opponents and would be constantly claiming the moral high ground.
Well, most revolutionaries do tend to criticize the old order as morally problematic, even morally bankrupt.
Well, I'm not sure it's completely fair to call Gandhi a revolutionary. He didn't lead an armed rebellion like most revolutionaries. And he and many of his followers were willing to be killed, but they weren't willing to kill.
Well, I guess the term revolutionary does tend to connote violence, so I'm not sure we have a good word for exactly what Gandhi was in our lexicon. But back to your point about Gandhi and morality. Surely, though, he thought that he had morality on his side.
Well, Gandhi was a deeply principled man who constantly strove to be on the side of morality. But he wasn't big on claiming to know the absolute moral truth. And he actually thought that the ethical condemnation of one's opponent was itself a form of violence, and he rejected all forms of violence.
I don't get it. If you have morality on your side, what's so bad about claiming that you do? Isn't that just stating what you believe to be true?
Well, first about the truth. Gandhi had a very complicated view about truth. He believed that there is such a thing as absolute truth. And he felt that he was on a quest to know the absolute truth. But he also thought that the quest for truth was unending and uncertain. Only God knows the absolute truth. And it's a form of arrogance to claim to have the absolute truth on your side in disputes among humans. We humans only know what Gandhi called relative truth.
So Gandhi was a relativist then? Is that why he rejected moral condemnation as a form of violence? I mean, relativists, after all, promote tolerance of competing points of view and competing moral outlooks.
Well, but relativists don't really believe in absolute truth, even as the elusive object of an unending quest like Gandhi did. So Gandhi was an absolutist, but some absolutists think they have a firm grip on the absolute truth. Under the illusion that they alone know the absolute truth, they lord it over those who disagree with them. Gandhi never pretended to know the absolute truth and didn't lord it over anyone.
Now, we got started down this road when you said Gandhi rejected criticizing the behavior of others. He saw that as a form of violence, you said. I'm still not sure I understand, Joe.
Well, look at it from the perspective of the opponent. If you constantly criticize your opponent, he'll see it as an attack. perhaps not as an attack on his physical person, but an attack on something that might be more important, his spiritual person. And that will put your opponent on the defensive.
Well, if you put it that way, I grant that moral condemnation is a kind of attack. But isn't it only an attack in a metaphorical sense? I mean, why should we think of moral condemnation as literally and truly a form of violence?
Well, violence takes many forms, not just physical. There's economic violence, cultural violence. Even in our professional philosophy, there's a certain kind of bullying in print that's sort of violent. Think of moral condemnation as just another form of violence, and Gandhi rejected all forms of violence.
Complicated man, that Gandhi, and a complicated thinker, too. I'm still not sure that what it all adds up to.
I'm in the same boat, Ken. Fortunately, we'll be joined by a man who has thought long and hard about Gandhi, Akhil Bilgrami, author of Gandhi the Philosopher.
And we'd also like to invite you, our listeners, to plumb the philosophical depths of this complex spiritual and political leader. The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, talks to someone who's been using elements of Gandhi's philosophy to solve real-world problems. She files this report.
It's no coincidence that Gandhi's grandson wrote the foreword to the book that explains nonviolent communication, or NVC. According to Arun Gandhi, his grandfather stressed the need to communicate nonviolently because he saw passive violence, the kind brought about by harsh, judgmental words, as being an underlying cause of physical violence.
You're so selfish.
That's John Kenyon, mediator and co-founder of the Bay Area Center for Nonviolent Communication, which is an approach developed by psychologist Marshall Rosenberg 40 years ago. NVC involves choosing to hear people's unmet needs beneath hostile language, like what you just heard. So instead of stomping my foot and shouting, "I am not selfish," I might hear,
"I have a need for consideration, for care of others that isn't being met." And I could focus on that as what the person is saying, instead of getting caught up in reacting defensively to a criticism. It's the idea of seeing our interdependence. If others' needs aren't being met, then my needs aren't being met.
Nonviolence isn't a technique to be used when you need it. And it's not being passive. It's really a philosophical worldview based in compassion and connection. And Gandhi didn't create it. He adopted the Hindu concept ahimsa, or doing no harm, and took it to new heights.
It's one thing to be loving and caring and kind to people, but can I do it when others are not being kind at all to me, or the opposite of kind and loving and cruel and oppressive? Can I still have love for that person? And nonviolent communication gives a way to do that by seeing the human needs that someone might be trying to meet, but in a very tragic way, in a very destructive way.
If you think this sounds touchy-feely, think again. NVC is used all over the world, in Israel and the Palestinian Authority, in Rwanda, with at-risk teens, between family members. John Kenyon wanted to do something positive after 9/11, so he went to a refugee camp in Pakistan filled with Afghan tribal members. He wanted to teach them nonviolent communication.
I believe that if we don't all come together and work together to solve these problems, from the local to the global, I don't think we're going to make it.
He was talking with elders from different tribes. Some of them wanted to invite him to mosque, others didn't. They started to fight.
They were talking in terms of judgments of what's right and wrong and good and bad and the way it should be or shouldn't be, and maybe criticizing the other side. And I just kept translating that and hearing what their needs were.
After much listening, John identified that one group wanted to show him hospitality. The other wanted respect for their tradition of Islam.
And then I turned to the whole group after we got the needs on both sides, and I said, "So, does anybody in the room not share all of these needs? The needs for connection and sharing and hospitality, and the needs for safety and protection and honoring traditions and practices?" There was kind of a stunned silence for a second. And then they all started smiling and nodding, and could see that everyone was getting that they all had those needs. It wasn't really, at that level, there was no conflict.
He suggested they work together to get all their needs met. One idea was to have John sit outside the mosque and hear the service, but that didn't work for everyone. So what was the resolution?
The last solution was to have someone sit with us that could explain what was going on in the mosque and what was happening, and we could see and be really right part of it, but we'd still be outside the door and not inside.
The tribal elders recognized how John had teased out their common ground. They laughed and clapped and talked together for a long while. And maybe, just maybe, the seed of a nonviolent way to communicate was planted. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest today is Akhil Bilgrami. He's a Johnsonian professor of philosophy at Columbia University, director of the Heyman Center for the Humanities, and author of the forthcoming book, Gandhi the Philosopher. Akhil, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken. Nice to be here.
Akhil, you're an academic philosopher who's published on a lot of standard subjects, all the boring stuff Ken and I publish on. But you've also written about Muslim identity and, of course, about Gandhi. As someone born and raised in India, I suppose you have a complicated relationship to the legacy of Gandhi. But how did you head down the road of dealing with Gandhi the philosopher?
Well, John, as you say, I was born in India, and I, from time to time, write about Indian politics and society and culture. And I found when I was in India that philosophy was really not being done at all in the departments of philosophy and in the academy generally. People were merely doing the history of Indian philosophy and weren't doing philosophy as you and I and Ken do it. So I started to think who in India did philosophy, who in India actually tried to think about philosophical topics and forge views of their own. And I found that really Gandhi was the only serious person in philosophy in the last century. There were a few others like Tagore and so on, but Gandhi seemed to me a very deep and profound and creative philosopher who had thought hard about the issues you and I think of, but mostly about politics, and tried to derive his politics, as I think, John, you put it in your initial description. He tried to derive his politics from very general metaphysical conceptions of the world and so on.
So you think that these different sides of Gandhi, spiritual leader, political leader, philosophical thinker, you think they make a coherent whole?
Well, I've written often to say that there may not be as much integrity and coherence as Gandhi thought there was, but that was certainly his aspiration to provide an integrated picture of these different aspects.
That's really interesting. I mean, Gandhi was not trained as a philosopher, as I understand it, although I guess when he was in Britain, he fell into kind of philosophical circles, but he never really had much formal training as a philosopher, right? So what led to him to want to derive a political strategy? And I also understood that this political strategy had its birth in South Africa and resistance, right? But, so what drove him to try and derive a political strategy from kind of first philosophical principles?
Well, just his philosophical instincts, I think. Primarily, his view was, he was a great critic of the Enlightenment. And in my own thinking, I think of him as being continuous with very radical critics of the Enlightenment in the Romantic tradition, but even before that, in 17th century dissent in England and Netherlands and Europe. Spinoza, for instance, and he's part of a tradition, not that he read those people, but he has serious affinities with them. So in that sense, he was a philosopher, I think, in the Romantic tradition.
Right. So, but I just want to understand, from the beginning, from the days in which he started leading South African Indians' resistance to various things that were happening there, was he driven from the beginning by a kind of philosophical outlook, or was it just gut instinct? I mean, a practical man doing practical things, or what? Philosophical side of him grow and deepen, or what?
Right. It grew, I think, early in the 20th century. When he wrote his book, Hind Swaraj, it was very deeply philosophical. So I think it began in the first decade of the 20th century. But initially, in the 1890s, when he was very active in South Africa and civil disobedience, he didn't have very many philosophical developed ideas.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, our guest is Akhil Bilgrami, author of Gandhi the Philosopher, a forthcoming book.
We've been talking about Gandhi as a spiritual and political leader who was also a philosophical thinker. We've been asking how the different aspects of this complex man added up to a unified whole. Next, we'll dig more into the details of Gandhi's wide-ranging philosophy. You can join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
Gandhi on truth, democracy, science, and a whole lot more, along with your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Can peace, love, and happiness help us solve moral and political disputes? This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. What Gandhi asked himself, we want to ask you. What is truth? Is truth merely relative, or is there such a thing as absolute truth? Is it arrogant to claim to know the absolute truth? Can appeal to moral principles help solve political disputes, or do they just get in the way?
The number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, and you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Akhil Bilgrami, author of Gandhi the Philosopher.
Akhil, in some of your writings, I read that you believe that Gandhi has what you call a moral notion of truth, not a cognitive notion. I've got a two-part question for you. First, I want you to explain that distinction, and then I'll follow up. Well, what distinction are you making when you distinguish between a moral and a cognitive notion of truth?
Right. Gandhi thought that if you take truth to be a predicate that applies to sentences or propositions, and not that he would put it this way, but if you thought of truth as a cognitive notion along those lines, you would have a overly intellectualized relation to the world. And that's what he was really opposed to. He thought the world was shot through with value. In fact, he thought it was shot through with the sacred, and that the world therefore made normative demands on us, including nature.
Wait, let's stop a minute. You're going, suppose I, it's over-intellectualized notion of truth. I think snow is white. That's either true or false. I say, yeah, right. It's true, yeah. And that's something I can know and believe. Is that what that's you right. mean by a cognitive notion of truth? I can have this added, right?
Right, that's right. So truth is the truth of propositions, which are made true by properties in the world.
How the world is, independently of me. Okay, that's the right. cognitive notion of truth. That seems pretty plausible, but tell me more about this moral notion of truth.
Right, so remember, his idea was that we should, our relations to the world should be relations of practical engagement rather than intellectualized, detached study of the world. Right? So it was a shift of emphasis. He wanted to urge that our relations to the world should be one of responding to its properties, which he thought were laden with value, laden with the sacred, which made normative demands on our agency. And so engagement with the world for him was much more important than detached study of it.
Let me try another gloss on this, see if I've got you. So the world kind of, if we understand it rightly, if we understand how the world is, it calls us to certain action. It calls us, it says, do this, be this, right? Resist this, cooperate here. So to understand the truth is to understand these demands that the world makes on us.
Exactly. And you know, when he said that there's no absolute truth, he thought different people might respond differently. But the important thing was responsiveness via our practical agency to the world. He wanted to stress that over a detached attitude toward the world, an attitude of explanation, study, and so on. So it was really a shift in emphasis. And let me try and say a little bit about why it was important for him to shift this emphasis. He thought that what happened when you stress science and detached intellectual explanatory forms of study was that you desacralized nature and the world. And he thought that was the beginning of a lot of social and cultural and political wrongs. He thought if you saw the world as desacralized, you would want to conquer it with technology, you know, because it was something alien. It didn't make normative demands on you. It's something you looked at from a very detached point of view.
I think you're answering the question I'm going to ask already, but I want to put it in certain context. Before you said he didn't like the Enlightenment. Now, come on. I mean, Obama likes the Enlightenment, and McCain likes the Enlightenment, and Bush likes the Enlightenment. As far as I know, Sarah Palin likes the Enlightenment. I mean, isn't that kind of the range of acceptable opinion about the Enlightenment? It was a great right. thing. I mean, who could be against the Enlightenment?
Right. Sure. Okay, so here is what he had in mind when he said that he wasn't particularly enthused by the Enlightenment. He, you know, he was essentially a religious person, and he thought that he had a kind of pessimism that a certain sort of religious person has, which is the main thing he objected to in the Enlightenment was that he thought the Enlightenment understood the social and political world in such a way that the worst tendencies in us were something that could be constrained by good politics, by good codes and constitutions and principles. And that was really the deepest commitment of the Enlightenment, and Gandhi didn't believe it. He thought that just politics of that kind was just simply not good enough. That we were capable of real harm, real evil, real violence, and so on. And the idea that codes and constitutions were conceived as sufficient was simply unacceptable. He thought people just have to change themselves and their character and their commitments, moral commitments.
Let me just frame what you said and see if I understand it, and then I'm going to let some callers in here. Right. So you said that Gandhi objected to the what you call the desacralization of the world. I mean, turns the world into brute, dumb matter that has no soul, no spirit, no values right. inherent in things. Right. I take it that part of that, maybe unintended, but part of that is it turns human beings into something weird, too. I mean, it turns the human beings into kind of self-interest-driven right. creatures that have to be right. constrained by politics of a certain kind. We get right. the Hobbesian state of nature and all that stuff, right. right, where the state doesn't have any antecedent hold on us, right, and we have to make it up, but we constrain it, and it's supposed to constrain us. And he thinks none of that works. It's a complete misunderstanding of right. the human being in the world. Oh, that's a profound criticism. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Gandhi as philosopher, and we'd love to have you join this conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got callers on the line now, Greg in East Palo Alto. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Greg.
Hello.
Hi, Greg.
Yeah. So my question was... Well, in your early discussion, you talked about how Gandhi had rejected the claim of moral superiority in its form of violence, and in that sense alone, regardless of its military actions, I would say the United States was perhaps the most violent nation in that sense, because we claim this enormous exceptionalism and moral superiority over basically everyone else in the world.
Okay, Greg, thanks for the comment. Gil, you want to react to that comment?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that you've got to understand is that Gandhi did not think that all violence came from individuals. He did think that built into certain institutions was a tendency of to violence. And one of the things he thought was built in violence was the corporation and also the state. So in some senses, he was an anarchist. And he thought that the only way to avoid violence was to make the centers of power very local and decentralized. So he would certainly say that governments, the United States, but many others too, had a built-in tendency to violence, and he thought only individuals were moral agents. So he said, I'm not going to criticize the British imperial state, because the British imperial state does what it does. It's built into it that it will have the dispositions to certain kinds of violence, and it's absurd to think that it will do anything else. So the only individuals are moral agents.
So is moral condemnation by appeal to moral principles? Okay, then. I mean, because I understood that he didn't like criticism, because it either led to violence or was a form of violence itself, and right, it wasn't an effective weapon for fighting the things you wanted to fight. But what about moral condemnation of individuals, the supporters of the British imperial state?
Right. So you know, he had a very radical view on that score too. He felt that it's very important not to have a morality based on principles, but rather a morality in which you just act so as to try and influence people through setting an example, through exemplary action. Now, this was, I think, an extremely subtle and curious sort of and very creative counter to a very standard way of thinking that goes back centuries in Western philosophy. And I think it's you know, it's very hard to make any sense of it unless you understood what kind of polity he wanted. I think it's an utterly implausible idea when you have highly centralized forms of power. But if you have very local communitarian forms of rule, he thought it was quite sufficient to just try and set an example and never to have a morality based on principles, criticism, contempt for people who fail to live up to principles, and so on.
So let me draw a kind of weird comparison here to see if I'm following you. So take Alan Greenspan, who has just had his worldview shaken. Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, Gandhi would actually have several things to criticize Greenspan about. First, Greenspan's psychology was an Enlightenment psychology that we all pursue our rational self-interest. Mm. And secondly, he magnified that psychology and used it to used it to form expectations about corporations, mm-hmm. which are not individuals. So it's no wonder that we're in the mess we are if it's based on such a colossal mistake. And in addition, I suppose he'd say Greenspan was wrong to worry about principles all the time anyway. He should have just set a better example, maybe by driving a Hyundai instead of whatever he drives.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's very hard to apply some of Gandhi's ideas to a scenario in which there's so much sort of division of labor, metropolitan ways of life, and so on. I just don't think it works. And he didn't want that kind of thing for India. So his moral philosophy was really geared to a sort of, not pre-modern India, but really the analogy is with early modern social life, which India had in the 1910s and 20s. And he didn't want it to change to the kind of life that, you know, Greenspan was part of, and the entire morality that Greenspan worked with was a completely different scene. I think he would, of course, say that the principles of corporations and so on that Greenspan was speaking to are just principles that, you know, this was inevitably going to happen. You can regulate it a little bit more than Greenspan wanted, but it was built into corporations that they seek profit and that they will do whatever they can to seek profit. They're not moral agents. They just do that. Yeah. That's what they're for.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about Gandhi the philosopher. We'd like you to join our conversation. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And Alberto in Sausalito's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Alberto.
Hi, good morning. I hope I'm on the cell phone, so unfortunately, I hope you hear me okay.
Okay, I just hope you're not driving.
Yeah, well, you know, it's something that we all, being raised in the U.S. and being born in Cuba has given me a sort of abstract view of life, because on both sides of the border, each one of them has said to each other that we are absolutely right, so we will continue to fight forever against each other's moral high ground, you know, political and moral high ground. And in my own life, I've seen that's, you know, a case where we have two individuals who see the world totally different, and have their truth to dictate what, you know, what and how they should live their life. But yet never the two shall ever meet. So is there a way that absolute world interpretation of truth can ever meet if it's so consistent?
So you're wondering how we can apply Gandhian ways of thinking and of being to resolving what look like intractable disputes. Akhil, can right. Gandhi give us any... Thanks, Alberto, for the call. Can Gandhi give us any real guidance here?
Well, you know, Gandhi didn't... I think you've got to understand that Gandhi was not always convinced that rational argument was essential to public life. So, for instance, take the fact that he thought that fasting was a way of reaching people. Now, that is as irrational as violence.
Yeah.
But it seems to have worked. That's right. So he was he wanted to reach people's conscience, and it didn't necessarily mean that you have to reach it by logical persuasion. And so I myself feel that violence and fasting are both completely irrational ways, because they just finesse the path of logical argument and try and reach people through other means. And
Gandhi doesn't really... I'm hearing you say that Gandhi, in a way, doesn't really have a theory of political discourse, at least doesn't have a complete theory of political discourse as we modern democratic liberals understand it. Is that fair?
That's right. He really didn't think that codes, constitutions, logical argument, etc. were... I mean, he thought you reach people by touching their conscience about what is right. You respond to the world's normative demands on you. And he was modest. He thought that the world might be seen to make different demands to different people, but the fact is that was, for him, morality. It was, and there was no absolute truth only in the... I mean, I think it's wrong to raise the question of relativism versus absolutism. He used those words from time to time, but what he meant was really that you shouldn't think of truth in cognitive terms. You should really see the world as making demands on you, and it's all right if people come from different cultures and so on, and see what demands are differently. And the way to do it is to do what your conscience tells you and set an example.
Right, right. I mean, I find that intriguing, but in the contemporary complex world, I wonder how really effective that is. And we'll take that question up after a break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Gandhi the Philosopher with Akhil Bolgrami, author of the forthcoming book, Gandhi the Philosopher.
We've been exploring Gandhi's philosophical ideas. In our next segment, we'll take a closer look at Gandhi as a political force. Just what made the strategy of nonviolent non-cooperation so successful? Is it an idea that can be exported? Can it work everywhere? Can it work here and now? If not, why not?
Exploring the cost and benefits of nonviolent non-cooperation and a discussion of the Academy Award-winning film Gandhi when Philosophy Talk continues.
Political leaders aren't always willing to really give peace and nonviolence much of a chance. But Gandhi made it the basis of his political platform. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking about Gandhi, the philosopher. Our guest is Akhil Bolgrami from Columbia University. And we've got callers on the line. Sue in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sue.
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
Having been a political activist for about 25 years or so, and some of the movements were informed by Gandhi's philosophies, but I think that a lot of groups aren't using it anymore. So my question is Gandhi's philosophy still relevant for today's politics?
What do you think, Akhil? Thanks, Sue.
Well, I think that the deepest point in Gandhi's political activism and the philosophy from which it flows is that one cannot have contempt for ordinary people. And I think that actually, let's just talk about America for the moment. Gandhi converted what was basically a movement of lawyers into a mass movement within 3 or 4 years of landing up in India from South Africa. It was a remarkable achievement. And the lesson to be learned from it, I think, is that some of the attitudes we have, that is, people of the metropolitan liberal left, like you and me, have towards ordinary people, towards the electorate, let's say, of the red states, which votes in large numbers for views that we don't like, for people with views that we don't like, and has conservative Christian religiosity and so on. It's natural for us to show contempt for them. Virtually at every dinner party I go to, there's contempt expressed by my friends for. And Gandhi, I think, thinks that's just incompatible with democracy. with belief in democracy, to have a contempt for ordinary people. And so he tried to analyze why it is that people have views which many of us find distasteful, and he always attributed it to a certain kind of influence of things like media and education and so on, that the people were instinctively, he thought, to be trusted in their moral and political judgment. And if there was anything that one disagreed with, it always came from the distortion of institutions and of a sort of cognitive warping of them. And this meant very deep with him. So he thought the only place where you could expect public education was not in universities, not in the media, but in popular movements.
So, it is so there. Akhil, just following up a bit on Sue's question. So we had Gandhi's in the 30s and 40s, and we had Martin Luther King in the 60s. Different times, different problems, but nonviolence seems to have been an effective, if not completely successful, solution in both cases. Could you draw some comparisons and then connect that with the current world we happen to live in?
Right. Well, I think the important thing is that you see, I think we've been so spooked by the aftermath of the French Revolution, the Jacobin aftermath of the French Revolution, that we think of mass movements and popular movements with some anxiety. And I think what Gandhi wanted to say was, and I think this was King's view too, was that once you have all the liberal apparatus set up, unlike in the aftermath of the French Revolution, once you have all the apparatus set up, then popular movements are the sites where people really get educated and where real change can take place. And I think that's absolutely true. If you look at how changes in labor policy were made in this country, it was entirely a result of popular movements. If you look at how civil rights came about, it was entirely a result of popular movements. Lyndon Johnson didn't promulgate anything. He simply signed on to something that he was forced to sign on to by a popular movement.
I want to amplify your point, because I think you're right about what popular movements have done, and I think the other side of that is what, let's call them, vanguard movements have done. But the revolutionary vanguard a la Lenin, they've produced in the 20th century at least many horrors, right? So the elite vanguard who says it knows the future and sees ahead of the people often leads us, not always, but often leads us to utter disaster.
Right.
Don't you agree? Would Gandhi agree with that?
That's right. There was not a trace of vanguardism in Gandhi. In fact, he was very deeply opposed to it. And so, as I was saying, that is why he thought that you've just simply got to trust the people's judgment on things. And if you disagree with them, you should try and analyze what it is that makes them. So the attitudes of contempt we have towards ordinary people is something that he just would have thought is incompatible. In fact, he once said, if I thought one person was very enlightened, and I thought everybody else was contemptibly sort of stupid and vile, why wouldn't I believe in enlightened monarchy? So he thought if you believe in democracy, you simply cannot have the attitudes we have towards the electorate of the red states, for example, or to the ordinary working people of India in his time.
We've got one last caller on the line, Leroy in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Go, Leroy.
Thank you. I wanted to make a comment on this thing that's always put forth, that the reason that India won its independence was Gandhi's tactics of nonviolence. And frankly, the Second World War and the outcome of that had much more to do with India's independence than anything that Gandhi did.
So, okay, thanks for the challenging comment. What do you think about that, Akhil? And then I want to ride on Leroy's question. I mean, even if it did play a huge role in India, it's a limited number of places, isn't it, where nonviolence could actually bring about a substantive... You couldn't have stopped the Nazis through nonviolence. Could you have?
Well, I think that's probably right. You couldn't have stopped the Nazis through nonviolence. But, you know, if you take Israel and Palestine today, I mean, I think it is quite insane to think that the Palestinians, despite their brutalization and subjugation, that they could possibly have any effective violent action against a state as powerful as Israel and backed by a much more powerful state like the United States. So I can see that desperation may make people violent and so on, but But it just is hopeless to think that that violence is going to... So I think it may just be strategically in most parts of the world when there's such powerful states that there isn't any hope for violent revolution or violent change of any kind.
But back to Leroy's initial point, that it was the World War II and the exhaustion of Britain that really undermined the British Empire in Asia. What do you think about that?
It's perfectly possible that the British would have left anyway. In fact, they left in a big rush, partly because of what you call exhaustion, but all sorts of economic sort of compulsions too. But that doesn't mean that Gandhi didn't have. I think Gandhi's influence in showing how empire can be opposed anywhere in the world was remarkable. Even so, who knows historically why, the British left India or France left Algeria or whatever. These things turn on a lot of different things. They're possibly overdetermined. But that doesn't mean that Gandhi's movement didn't have an enormous, both ideological, intellectual, as well as practical effect.
So I want to try out one last thing on you. You've kind of convinced me that Gandhi as political strategist for undoing oppression was brilliant. But Gandhi as what the polity should be like post undoing the oppression, he seems to me a man of a different time, a man out of time, pre-modern in a way.
That's right. Early modern, he was living in a context of relatively early modern society, and so he still had desperate hopes that India wouldn't go the way of capitalist modernity, basically. And a lot depends on what your views are. I think if right now most of the world, except perhaps Cuba, is just caught up in a financial global system, and it's very hard to oppose it. Once you're caught up in it, it's very hard to oppose it, and I think you're probably right.
Well, Akhil, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really fascinating conversation.
All right. Very nice to talk.
Our guest has been Akhil Bograhmi. He's the Johnsonian Professor of Philosophy at Columbia University. He's director of the Heyman Center for the Humanities and author of the forthcoming book, Gandhi the Philosopher.
Now, let's take Philosophy Talk to the movies.
John, we've been talking about the philosophy of Gandhi. Let's talk about the movie Gandhi.
Ken, one of the things I had forgotten about the movie was the sense it gives you of India, how many people there are in India. How rural it is in spite of the huge population. Now, all that's changing now, but it was definitely true at the time Gandhi was fostering Indian independence.
I should say about this, Sir Richard Attenborough, who directed this movie, had been trying to make it for a very long time. It turns out to have been a true labor of love. He was very gripped by the story of Gandhi, and he wanted to make this a movie. I can't remember for how long he was trying, but it took him so long to get the movie made that all the people he had originally thought of playing Gandhi were too old by the time he made it to play the young Gandhi, so he settled on this young, amazing actor, Ben Kingsley.
Mohandas K. Gandhi, attorney at law. I'm on my way to Pretoria to conduct a case for an Indian trading firm.
Didn't you hear me? There are no colored attorneys in South Africa.
Sir, I was called to the bar in London and enrolled at the High Court of Chancery. I am, therefore, an attorney. And since I am, in your eyes, colored, I think we can deduce that there is at least one colored attorney in South Africa.
So whenever we look at a past historical era, we do so in terms of what turned out to be the case, how it ended up. When you look at the Civil War, you think of Lincoln just as being in charge. When you look at the independence of India, you think of nonviolence and Gandhi. But the film makes clear what we often forget, that everybody who was involved in the action didn't know how it was going to turn out. The original leaders of the independence movement didn't know that Gandhi was going to be the one that stood out and the one that became famous and the one that solidified India. They thought him as maybe a peripheral useful figure because he had a reputation from his work in South Africa.
We hope you're going to join us in our struggle for home rule, Mr. Gandhi.
Well,
excuse me, may I, Mohan?
There's someone I would like him to meet.
Oh, excuse me.
He told the press he'd support the British in the war.
That's nonviolence for you.
And I think one thing the film Gandhi does is really bring forward, bring home that sense of non-inevitability about the fact that he became the leader and that his ideas of nonviolence prevailed.
You know, in the movie Gandhi, it's important to look at the dynamics that the movie represents, this debate over whether to be violent or nonviolent has. I mean, there are lots of times when violence breaks out. There's a massacre, a famous massacre, in which thousands of Indian women, children, and young men and older men are killed, just cold-bloodedly killed. And you might think that would bring the whole thing tumbling down. And it threatened to bring the whole strategy of nonviolence tumbling down. But it didn't. And a lot of it has to do with Gandhi's will.
What if they don't arrest you? What if they don't react at all?
The function of a civil resistor is to provoke response. And we will continue to provoke until they respond or they change the law. Mm-hmm. They are not in control. We are. That is the strength of civil resistance.
I mean, I wonder about the historical accuracy in one way. I have no scholar, but I'd love to have some scholar tell me. I mean, was it really the force of will of Gandhi that held this nonviolent revolution together?
I'm sure that I mean, behind every great person, great leader, there's always some good luck when it comes to lieutenants. And you might say behind every disaster, there's always some bad luck. But you have Nehru, who became the first prime minister of India, was Gandhi's lieutenant in all things. And he, I think, was an excellent organizer and a firm disciplinarian. But no movie can really portray all of the work behind the hero or the main character. And I suspect in the case of Gandhi, that's especially true.
Look, for a three-hour movie, I've forgotten how extremely good Ben Kingsley, who won an Academy Award for this movie, how extremely good he was in this movie. I can show you in the DVD that was released way after the movie was made, there's some footage of the actual Gandhi. There's some newsreel footage, and I watched all the newsreel footage. And Ben Kingsley just nails Gandhi to the T. His mannerism, his looks, the way he walks, the sound of his voice, the cadence of his voice. It's amazing. It's an amazing performance.
So in today's world, there's two good reasons to go see Gandhi, apart from just the fact that it's a good movie. In the first place, politically, relations between Pakistan and India aren't very good, and that's an extraordinarily important fact that needs to be dealt with before a lot of other facts, like the presence of terrorists in Pakistan, can really be dealt with. And to understand that, how there came to be two countries in the first place, this will be a very helpful educational lesson for you. The second reason is that now when you go to the movies, you see kind of a steady diet of either violence or sophomoric male humor, and this movie is a good reminder of the great days of cinema.
So if you go rent the DVD of Gandhi, you can see philosophy in action through nonviolence.
You don't think we're just going to walk out of India?
Yes. In the end, you will walk out. Because 100,000 Englishmen simply cannot control 350 million Indians if those Indians refuse to cooperate. And that is what we intend to achieve. Peaceful, non-violent, non-cooperation. Till you yourself see the wisdom of leaving, Your Excellency.
Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in their own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Golden, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.